Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 269. And I'm joined this week by the legend, Dexter Fletcher. This is a really good chat. It's the first time I've met Dexter, and I feel we hit it off. We talk about a lot of stuff. Obviously, the focus, or one of the focuses, is Rocketman. It's the new film he's directed, the Elton John biopic, which is out today. As I'm recording this, let me have a quick look. The reviews are ridiculous. It's 90% on Rotten Tomato, 4 out of 5 on Empire, 7.8 on IMDb. I can't wait to see it, you know. It looks really good. The clips I've seen have been fantastic, and the chat that we had was wonderful. So, yeah, I think you're going to enjoy this one. Before we get into it, we're brought to you, as ever, by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's my label and web store and merch store. I've just launched, a lot of you will know, I have these sunglasses that every time I release, they sell out in like a day or so. So we've decided this year, I've just done a limited black and gold version that have the label slogan of "we may not be for you and that's fine" on them, and they're in the web store now. Or I mean, as I record this, they should be in there now. They may have sold out already, but hopefully not. I've ordered a fair amount because we're only going to do the gold ones for this a one time, I think. So there's that. Patreon, we've just had Distraction Pieces Rewind podcast episode on Patreon. It's only $1 a month. There's all sorts of preview stuff. There will have been posts, photos this week of who I recorded a podcast with on Monday and who I recorded a podcast with on Tuesday. So yeah, loads of good stuff over there. And finally, we're going to get into the podcast, I promise. If you're about on Saturday, come down and hang out with me and Stu Whiffin and previous guest Doc Brown, Lindy Layton, who me and Fatboy Slim talked about a lot last week about how wonderful a human and DJ she is. We're all going to be at my club night, We Are Lizards, at the Book Club on Saturday, the 25th of March. It's 8 p.m. till 3 a.m. It's free before 9 o'clock. It's a fiver, and then the price rises at a certain point, I think 11 or something. But yeah, come down, hang out. If you want photos or anything signed or anything like that, that's absolutely fine, but if you can come earlier the better, because when it around 10-11ish it starts to get rammed and sweaty, and to be frank, I start to get quite drunk, so any of those kind of interactions always play out better the earlier you get there, and we'll have more time. I'll be there from like 7-8ish before we even open, so come on down to that. But yeah, for now, this is episode 269 of the Distraction Pieces Podcast with the legend, Dexter Fletcher. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
But, hello, yeah. Hello, 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 London.
Oh, right, we go. That's so perfect.
Cheers. All right, good.
I'm joined today by Dexter Fletcher. How are you, sir?
I'm very good, Pip. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. How's it all going? It feels like you're at a point that you've been building up to for a while now with Rocketman.
Yes.
On the verge. How does it feel? Because it's been kind of nice with, particularly with your directorial career. It feels like it's been, and The film industry can often be the complete opposite, but it feels like it's been a really nice ramping up and progression of size, scale, and pressure, I guess. So
pressure, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point. I've tried to pace myself. I mean, that's been slightly dictated by me and slightly dictated by others in a way. But I certainly didn't want to run before I could walk, because with my first film, Wild Bill, it was, you know, I presented the script that I co-wrote to a producer who just automatically assumed that I wanted to direct it. And I realized in that instant that if I didn't say, yes, that was the plan, that then it reduced the chances of that film getting made. So when she said, and you'll direct it, I just went, yes, absolutely, that's the plan, because that seemed to be what would get it going. So it's sort of, although I'd been, you know, around a periphery of directing for many years.
Yeah.
That sort of led me into it. Not by any great design, but then I found once I started and while Bill did well and people responded to it so well that and then other offers came in that he was an opportunity for sort of like change sort of direction or add a new chapter to my career in a
it's,
way.
It's kind of a weird pressure and ego boost at once, right? When they're like, oh, you're going to direct, because I've got a script in development with Warp, a TV thing.
Yeah.
And they were the same, like, and you're going to direct, right? I was like,
yeah.
No, I don't know how to do it. And they were instantly like, no, you can, it's all there. Yes. And it's kind of that weird thing of going, wow, this is great. But then also that fear of, fuck, well, they think I can do it. I don't know if they think I can, I guess I can.
I know. I think it's just the assumption by people that that's what you would plan to do. Yeah. And so if they assume that that's why you've written it, because you want to direct it, then they assume that you must have a vision and a plan for it, which I suppose you've got to have to a greater or lesser extent if you're writing it. But it's you imagining yourself in that position then and then going, yeah, right, no, that's the plan. And because it's very different then when you start taking on other people's material. Because then you've really got to start drilling down into what is directing really about. Because when it's your own vision, your own thing, you've got access to the ideas and the vision much more readily.
You know,
you can dip into where your imagination's been, but
you knew it from the start. You knew it from the conception of it.
Yeah, yeah. And so you just start filling in that picture even more, whereas then when you start taking another material, you have to, follow that blueprint, but create the work. And that, again, is a whole nother leap. But that's how I think I didn't, you know, just to get back to your first sort of question or what you're talking about, is that I tried not to go too big too quick because I realized that there was, if I was serious about it, there was a learning curve that I had to 100%. be aware of. And that if I really wanted to, you know, get it to the highest level I could, see how far I could go with it, that I shouldn't run before I could walk.
Yeah.
And it's a good place to be with directing. I know I have a lot of experience, but to understand there's still a lot for me to learn and be open to that.
Completely. And again, it is the more you look at it, it's that rare. It's always with hindsight, it can look as if you had a grand plan or whatever else. But again, it is one that it feels like there's no one who was more prepared to direct Rocket Man than you, because you've worked with Taron on a biopic.
Yeah.
And then you've worked on a musical biopic with Bohemian Rhapsody and before that on Sunshine on Leaf with the musical element.
Yeah.
So it felt like, wow, you've done all the training to lead up to this huge pressure project.
I suppose so, exactly. I mean, yes, you know, that is, I mean, I suppose that, yeah, the previous work leads me to this in a quite sort of secure way in terms of stuff that I've looked at before, even with Wild Bill and Sunshine on Leaf. There's this kind of social realism to them that I kind of like to bring into Rocket Man as well, so that I have an element of fantasy that I can break free from. That's the new step for me, is like, how do you become visionary in terms of the fantastical and fantasy element of Rocket Man that it has, and I feel that kind of works really interestingly and successfully, that we have people sitting around a kitchen table that then break into song or dance numbers and stuff. It is always about like pushing your own personal boundaries and what challenges you, but having a foot, I suppose, in a more familiar territory, so that those people who are stumping up all that money and faith in you, because that's another element of it, to go, okay, well, look, there's a comparison here that we can see that he's got the experience. But even similarly with my acting career, you know, with Bugsy Malone when I was a kid and watching Alan Parker and talking to him as I get older and knowing him or David Lynch and Jarman, and you know, I look back on all these incredible directors I've been around, Hugh Hudson and
such early ages as well to get influenced by them. That must be amazing.
Exactly. And I don't know if at the time you're kind of, or I was aware that, oh, I mean, in the presence of these mavericks, you know, but that sort of stuff I can't ignore or deny myself as I get older and I venture further into being a director. It's like, what really did I glean there? What really, you know, what influence did that have on me? Or you know, what environment was I in that also lends itself to creating something like Rocket Man, you know, these imaginative leaps. I mean, someone like Gothic with Ken Russell was completely out there. And
it will have been a kind of being in school without realising you were in school, right?
Because
David Mamet talks a lot about how the institutes of film schools and acting schools are often quite restrictive and they teach you one way of doing things, or they're there to feed themselves and continue to be a learning thing. Whereas if you learn on stage, then that's the best place to learn and the best way to learn. So growing up, being your only experience of film, being these amazing directors who've got all this experience, that's got to have kind of been a better way to learn than you could ever learn from books or on paper.
I appreciate absolutely what you're saying. I mean, better, worse, you know, good. Sure. I mean, that's another thing, you know, because we all experience it and have our own journey to make.
Yeah.
I just had to get my head wrapped around the fact that I was in those environments and that obviously they played their part in influencing me. And maybe I don't have, you know, a traditional kind of formatted learning structures or curriculums that I follow that some people may other people may do that works for them. But I was there on the ground, and I have to at some point sort of, you know, it's very easy when you grow up in that environment to kind of write it off as like, oh, I just happened to be there. But the older you get, the kind of more you realise, oh, no, I happened to be there.
Yeah.
It's a very different understanding of what it was, you know, and giving that some sort of credit and not sort of, you know, for many years, I just, you know, it kind of passed me by. But I don't think it could have done, because I know I have my way of it, of working. And that's obviously a sum of its parts as well. And as well as who I am as a filmmaker. And so I think it's just what road you get on, what route you're on. And I'm just very lucky, that I was in the presence of some really, you know, I've been around 50 years, you know, for acting and being a kid on set. And you know, those things obviously really put me in an interesting place in terms of where I am. Because I've come to filmmaking relatively late. I mean, some people may go to film school and study, and, you know, by the time they're in their 30s, they're really rocking and rolling.
Yeah.
But it's took me a bit longer.
I want to talk more about your acting later on in the conversation, because you've definitely been in loads of things that have been a huge part of different points of my growing up in love with TV and film and cinema and things like that.
But
I think you touched upon A Sunshine on Leith briefly there, and I think because I think it will have been a big tool and learning station, I guess, towards Rocket Man.
Yeah.
How was it to be telling the story of somewhere like Glasgow, but with all
Edinburgh.
Edinburgh.
Yes, right. We filmed it in Glasgow, though.
Right, yeah. Well, there you go. I'm missing bits there. But so telling the story of somewhere like Edinburgh that's more a folklore-type area than a Disney musical type place.
Yeah.
But you kind of had that beautiful opportunity to tell this story and, as you said, subvert reality with the musical element. And musicals are something that I think it's often easier for us to suspend our disbelief on stage, because you're in a theatre, you're suspending your disbelief anyway.
Mm-hmm.
On film, it can be a tougher thing. So how was that for you to approach as a challenge of going, right, I want to keep it gritty and real and tell this amazing city story, but I want to have this magic and I want to have this freedom to go, at the snap of a finger, we're all singing and dancing. How was that to approach and try and find the way to make it work smoothly, I guess?
Well, I think the difference maybe between Sunshine on Leith and Rocket Man, for example, and what you're talking about is what comes to mind is, you know, there's a certain theatricality to musicals that are undeniable. You know, you when in the theatre you're in a completely very obvious sort of manufactured environment.
Yes.
Of course, with Sunshine on Leith, we're trying to do something that's very real. And so I was always very much of a mind with Sunshine on Leith that it didn't become theatrical, that it stayed a kind of social realism drama, as it were. And so I and the only time it does that really is at the end.
Yeah.
When it becomes this sort of flash mob idea. Yeah. And even then it's a flash mob. And the thing that's great about a flash mob is that everybody joins in.
Yeah.
And it's very ragged around the edges. And indeed, local people were walking through Edinburgh and we were filming on the streets for 3 days and they just joined in because the dance numbers are relatively simple, 10 yeah. move kind of thing. But there was 500 people doing it and locals and joined in, as I said. So it kind of gave it, it kept it very sort of real. And it's yeah. only in that last moment that it really sort of, it burst out into full on kind of theatricality.
And it was the beauty of it's building up to a payoff anyway. It's not, yeah. you're not getting it early. It allows that because you've been so restrained
yeah.
throughout. Then it's a reward to go all singing, all dancing.
Exactly.
Let's go proper musical.
Exactly. And let it be rough around the edges. Yeah. It's kind of, that's the fun of it. But I realised very quickly that I had to set out the stall. I had to say, it's going to be real, but people are going to sing. So yeah. in Sunshine and Leith, I made sure that the first thing that you heard was singing. They're in yeah. the back of a personnel, armoured personnel character.
Yeah.
And the first thing they do is sing. So that it looks very rugged and real and very, you know, sweaty, gritty bloke sitting in the back of a armoured personnel carrier, but they sing. And immediately the audience just get with that idea, that concept that yeah. people are going to sing. And it doesn't really stray too far from that. You know, it does keep even all the singing happens in a very real environment. It
Completely.
Never. And obviously I chose things that looked as cinematic as possible, but I,
sure.
there's very little choreography in any of it
yeah.
right until the end. And that's intentional.
And I think the reaction of the other people in the scenes is very real because it is their kind of,
yeah.
they'll look round at
yes,
someone. Because
yeah.
again, in a musical, people are singing, dancing, and a lot of music, everyone's fine with that.
Joined
I love that if
yeah.
you started doing it in Scotland, people would be like,
"What's that?
What are these two lads doing?
Exactly.
Why are they singing, walking down the street?"
But precisely.
It makes it real in that way.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what that very clearly wanted. I very clearly wanted to do. I wanted to create a musical that didn't feel like a musical.
Yeah.
It's really about relationships and love, and how do we navigate it? New love, old love. And love that's no longer there. You know,
yeah.
there's all these different themes. It's about relationships. It's very simple in that respect. But my wife works in opera. My
right.
wife has an opera company, and
wow.
she directs and produces opera. And obviously, we talk a lot about it. And it was her who said, when all these scripts came in after Wild Bill, this is the one you should look at. This is interesting because it's so different,
and it's
rooted in this theatrical experience that's been on stage for 3-4 years,
yeah,
and it's been
completely.
Developing, and so there was a really good. I really responded to that material, and
yeah.
and then we just, you know, talked about the nature of what is the song and what when people sing, and it's like an aria in an opera, you know, where the characters stop when they sing what's inside,
yeah.
and that idea I really grasped onto, and it's something that I try to bring to Rocket Man as well, is that. That when people sing, that we're hearing their inner voice. We all sort of wear masks and have day-to-day life.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting and huge element of acting, you know, is like the personas and masks that we adopt in certain situations. And the real drama is when the audience know what's really going on internally, but see what the cover is. Because we all recognise
yeah.
that in
yeah.
our own day-to-day experience and life, that we have to feel like shit, but go out and say morning to the
yeah.
postman,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
and pretend everything's great. So the song is the moment where if that all falls away, and I really like that opportunity to do that, to explore that. It's the what I call the to be or not to be moment, when
yeah.
Hamlet turns to the audience and says, "Do I live? Do I die? What do I do?" And so that is became very exciting and intriguing to me, but I didn't want it to become theatrical. This environment, these characters, this world didn't call for that.
Yeah.
It didn't. And I think that was what the piece was never developed really as that. It always felt very real. And I also had to learn about Edinburgh. I had to learn about
yeah.
this kind of Scottishness of it, which of, you know, being a Londoner, I had to sort of come away from my environment and go and say, well, what defines being Scottish? And I realised that was something I didn't have to really try and do. What am I going to have everyone running around in kilts eating, you know, haggises and playing
yeah.
the fucking bagpipes?
I've
got to let them be who they are, you know, and be in the environment. The environment makes them who they are,
yeah.
you know, and the bigger questions and bigger issues are just about these human relationships.
Yeah.
And that sort of made it more Scottish in a way than anything I could have tried to do
yeah.
by letting it be in,
yeah.
in that respect.
And you've got the amazing back catalogue there as well
yeah,
to tell that. And as a kid, I thought the Proclaimers were a comedy band almost.
Because
In the UK, like when 500 Miles Blub, it was all, oh, look at their funny voices.
Yeah,
this.
Twins
and then
as
soon as I grew up and got into them, I used to have a radio show on XFM that was hip hop, just or rap and spoken word.
Yeah.
And even on that, at one point, I ended up just trying to convince the audience how great the Proclaimers are because they're such good storytellers.
Absolutely.
They've written, I was excited to watch Sunshine on Leaf because I think they've written the two best love songs and they're very cinematic. And then I met you, and Sunshine on Leaf are two of the most cinematic, beautiful love songs that you could instantly, before I watched the film, I was like, well, they're going to be, that's going to be an amazing moment in a film.
So
I guess the back catalogue there as well gives you a lot of the heart of Scotland, I guess.
Yeah.
You've got that.
Exactly. Why trying out Scottish, you know, Charlie and Craig?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
And what they're doing is the very fabric of what they sing and why they sing it and how they sing it and why they write what they write and their connectivity to that experience. Sunshine on Leith, it doesn't get more ingrained in it. You know, they gave me all of that. They authenticated everything that I was trying to look at in a way that I could never run around, like I said, and try to find and so that's why I think it carries so well. It feels really honest and a part of Scottish identity. That's my biggest hope. That when Scots watch it, they go, home, you know.
Yeah.
And because that's also what the film's about. It's about home. But that's, like you say, what, all of what the lyrics and the music and what Charlie and Craig bring as the gift. And it's not being blind to that and going, right, that's that, and accepting that's the case.
Yeah.
Either people buy into it or they don't. But their world that they write about is inherently authentic, I say. And
there was completely.
Massive boost. So
how much do you feel pressure or relief of pressure is added when working on a project that's based in reality, that's based on truth and a biopic? Because it's a really tough one. My first instinct is that it leads the story so much. You don't have to have that moment of, well, that had never happened, because it did fucking happen. So it can be that you don't have to question that. But then equally, I think what a lot of people in recent times forget is a biopic isn't a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
It's a dramatisation. It doesn't have to tell every moment of this point. You have to draw out the bits that make that story and that journey work and flow. So how do you approach that as the director and going, right, here's how we're going to tell this story and here's how we're going to honour reality and subvert reality?
Mm. Yeah, I don't know if it's a subversion of it. I tell you, but honouring it is certainly a key part of it. And you know, you spread out the whole story in front of you and you look at what these facts are but like you say, it's not a documentary, and really essentially what a film gets down to or a story gets down to is, what is the story that I'm telling? There's always got to be a story that, you know, if you're just telling a factual relaying of they did this and then that happened and this happened, yeah, sure, you've got these road marks along the way, but it's like how you connect the psychological and emotional journey of this character or these characters, how do they all tie together? What's the journey? What are we trying to talk about? What are, you know, the bigger themes, the human themes that we all as an audience, we sit and connect and understand. And that's got to be the priority, not the facts of what happened. And it's difficult because, especially with people like Freddie or Elton or even Eddie the Eagle, there's a lot of people who are experts on their life story.
Completely.
And when you're not trying to dishonour that, what you're trying to do is jam that 30-year story or that 5-year journey or whatever it is into 2 hours at tops.
Yeah.
And so what you have to honour, what I try to honour, what I try to understand is that, do I love this character in the middle of it? Do I, as the director, do I want to tell their story? What is this element of their life that I'm extracting, that I'm talking about, that I'm telling them? And then how do I keep that all going and using those events along the way? And that means sometimes you have to invent or amalgamate or swap round or ignore or absolutely be on the money with different factual elements of it. And it's only allowing yourself as the storyteller, as the filmmaker, to understand what the larger picture is that frees you from just being like, oh God, but they aren't the fucking shoes he wore. Yeah. And that's, sure, that's important. And yeah, there's an element of that. But if he's got to wear fucking trainers at that moment in order to tell us the emotional journey, the psychological point that that character is at that time, so we understand what the payoff is, so we understand when we get to the end of it, oh, now I recognise where we are.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you've got to make those sacrifices. Yeah. You know, I realised it with Eddie the Eagle is that it's a very simple thing, but the ski boots that Michael Eddie Edwards wore back in 1984 or whatever the year was, I now forget, don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
They're illegal to jump with. Yeah. What he jumped with, what everyone jumped with back in the 80s,
right,
just don't have, you can't do it. So I meant I could have no one jump in those boots. Not only did they not exist, if they did, it would be illegal and I would be able to film no ski jumping.
Yeah.
No one would be able to jump in them. Yeah. They're just outlawed.
Yeah.
So I was like, what the hell am I going to do? Oh, there's all these visual effects. We'll have to rebuild the boots in rear effects. And it's massive amounts of money and very complicated. And I want to get, you know, do I really have to worry about the strapping on his boots?
Yeah.
Or do I want to get a big stadium shot in there? Which yeah, is what really is cinematic and is important.
Yeah.
Whereas one or two people are going to be looking at the boots going, oh, those boots are wrong.
Yeah.
So I just went, fuck it. We're not going to do, we're not going to worry about the boots.
Yeah.
And if I get taken to task for it, that's the way it is. But what's more important is that he did the jump.
Yeah.
That he did these jumps and he did them at this time in his life for yeah, this reason. You've got to prioritise, and I always prioritise the human and emotional and psychological journey over the facts.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a risk because people are absolutely love their heroes and they want to see certain milestones and they want to see them in the way that they can look in a book
yeah,
and go, well, that's the exact moment there and it looks identical.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I understand that and I respect it, but I can't adhere to it because
yeah,
I have to tell a film and I want to share that story with loads and loads and loads and loads of people.
Yeah.
Not just four people who go, oh, well, actually, they're the wrong boots.
Yeah, completely.
And that sort of carries through. It's tricky. It's a risk in a sense, but you've got to be free to be able to tell the story, I suppose.
Yeah, it's fascinating because it's the same challenges and conflicts that you would go through writing a fictional script. There could be yeah, scenes that you're like, this is beautiful, but it doesn't add to anything. So I yeah, now as an artist have to get rid of that. Even though I love that scene,
yeah,
I have to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Yet you've suddenly got the pressure of other people
yeah,
who
yeah,
are then going to care that you've got rid of it. Yeah, if it's yeah, your own, then you have to live with the fact that, well, no one ever knew about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's sad because I love that one shot yeah, or that yeah, one scene, but yeah, it doesn't add anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got that added outside,
you get that in the edit as well. You create stuff
going to care.
You create stuff that you shoot and then you put the assemble the film and you go, this is a brilliant performance, but it doesn't serve the
yeah,
story.
Yeah.
And that's, I suppose, it's the same thing. You know, this is a great, beautiful fact that is a milestone. It doesn't serve the story.
Yeah.
Because, like you say, it's not a documentary. If you're doing a docudrama, fine.
Yeah.
You should absolutely adhere to that.
Completely.
But in my experience, in the things that I've been tackling, I have to find a way of freeing myself up. And it's why, with Rocket Man, when Elton's our narrator, that he's telling the story, I very quickly said to everyone, it's his imagination, it's his recollection.
Yeah.
So that means it's fallible or it's embellished.
Completely.
Or he's got it wrong or he's misremembering, which frees it up in another way.
Completely.
And hopefully that's something that the audience just get very quickly
yeah,
and go on the journey.
Anyone that's so documented from such an yeah, early point in their life, no one will be able to know how true any memories are. Because,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like as we have with old photos, you have old photos, you remember that moment, but it's because you've looked at that old photo
yeah,
loads of times.
Yeah, yeah.
You were three in that photo. Yeah. You don't remember that fucking moment, but
no.
You kind of think you do. So that's going to be magnified tenfold by someone like Elton, who was just in the public eye for so long
mm-hmm,
and so many times. It's going to be this a romanticised
yeah,
version
of
his life.
Exactly. And even our memories become stories very quickly. You
yeah,
know, I can tell you about some holiday I went on or whatever. And it's a story now.
Yeah.
It's and so once something becomes a story, it's why, you know, people, you know, had bolt-ons or whatever. They, yeah. Oh, yeah, no. Well, we went down the track and there was this, you know, the bear was 7 foot tall.
Yeah,
it was
a
raccoon or something. But I don't know. Do you know what I mean? It's like it has to become something that engages, that we sit around a fire and tell the story as it flickers on the wall, the light, and, you know, it all harks back to, you know, that collective experience of telling a story. And everyone being engaged and engrossed, and that's what you know you got to be open to.
Yeah, I love that. I'm fascinated by the different approaches to directing and how it is to be a director. And as you touched upon, particularly when you're directing something that someone else has written. So, how much of the work do you feel as a director is done before you even step on set? Because I think the casting, the putting together of your team and your crew, so much of that, if you've done it right, should allow your job on set to be that bit easier, because you've got a DOP that you trust, you've got actors that you trust. So the hope I always feel would be that you can step back slightly and say, you know, do your thing. We've got the right actors, we've got the right team. How much of that's a reality and how much is a romanticised version of things in my own head of how it can work?
Well, I mean, if I prep really well when you get to it, I can just sit back and say action and cut.
Or a balance, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is an element of that. Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, anything prepped well is, you know, you fail to prepare to fail.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
you know, that's obvious in anything. For me, you've got to be open to the moment when there's magic that happens. And sometimes you're the only one who can see that. You know, that element for me is about, once you've assembled all these fantastic people and they're working towards the vision that you are trying to create and you want to create, that by accident or design, inadvertently or not, things happen that expand it and open it up in a different way. And that's the moment that you've got to be ready for. That's not about prep. That's about, you know, that you can't be prepared for. That you've got to be able to go, this is a moment I need to seize. This is something that is happening here and now, which is in the immediate, and then about performance and about elements coming together. And I think I would worry if I just got to the set and was just like sitting there, like, okay, this is all going to kind of happen. And I'll just go, yeah, that's great. I suppose, you know, there's
good
a degree
work,
of that.
Everyone.
Yeah, good work. Another day is done. And then there is an element of that, you know, with very things that are very technical. But also you've got to be alive to the fact or sensitive to the fact that you're going to get it in the edit and you need to keep it. It needs to still live, you know, and that's about keeping it alive on the set. I mean, I would worry personally that those things, you know, that are kind of just about, okay, well, the prep's done and here it is.
Yeah.
And here's the storyboard. Let's shoot that. That you don't leave yourself open to, we need to keep it alive. We need to do something here. We need to, and that for me is the creative element of the job that you bring to the set when you go there. When you come in each day and you assess how people are feeling and working, and because you need to keep that moving. You need to keep people engaged and understand that everyone's where they're at because they've worked their bollocks off to get there.
Yeah,
and the, you know, shoots are long and hard and tiring and exhausting and. And you have to remind people and not let that fatigue become the predominant feeling, you know, because you can do that after. I mean, I suppose it would be great if you could do all the prep and it all just happened. I just would never trust that. Maybe that's just my nature. I really enjoy being on a set. I love being there. I think it's something from my childhood that's why I understand most clearly who I am, because that's where I was always placed, to go on stage, get out and do it. So for me, it's a very exciting and energising environment anyway.
Yeah.
And that's what I want from everyone, because I believe that translates into what you see. And of course, prep's absolutely massive, you know, especially the more money that's involved and people and expertise and skill. I just always want the expertise and skill to be the bedrock of, now give me your poetry, give me your inspiration, bring what you can bring to it, because there's a moment here for you to do something great.
Yeah.
And even at people at their worst are really brilliant. If you, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
But because everyone's worked hard there and to get there. Now everyone starts as the runner.
Yeah.
As the person who makes a cup of tea.
Completely.
On the set. There's no way. You, sure, you go to film school, but then you've got to come out. You still got to be a runner.
Yeah.
You know, people still got to make tea and for the camera department and work their way up.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you don't stay as just come straight in as a boom op.
Yeah.
You've got to work your way up. Everyone,
completely.
And that means they put a lot of time, effort and passion into it. And that's what I like to. I started as an extra.
Yeah.
You know, when I was 6 years old, admittedly, yeah. But I did start. That's, you know, no one walks into being a movie star.
Yeah.
No one walks into being a director. You. So that for me is kind of important, that there's like, yeah, there's something to be, to achieve here, to move on, to move it forward, to move it forward. Let all of us on in our own department. We can, this is a chance for us to move forward. Bring your best.
Yeah. I love that. I love the highlight on directing the mood and the tone of the set as much as, you know, on camera and off camera.
Yeah,
I started acting only 3-4 years ago, so very late to it. And the thing that I found really quickly, and again, it worked in my favourite points, because I was just always so excited to be there, to be involved, because this is, I've been watching for years, I've done music for 10 years and then I've made this move. But then you do see quite quickly that people have been doing this for years and they do know it's long days.
Yeah.
And that excitement and buzz can be a tough thing to maintain, but it's an important thing to maintain.
Absolutely.
So bringing that back out of people, it's someone who, I want to talk about your cast, but the third acting gig I had, I was paired up with Stevie Graham.
Yeah.
And he took me under his wing massively, and he's been a good friend and mentor since then. But the thing that he always liked was that every morning he'd get, and I'd be like, have you seen the new thing they've put up? It's amazing. Like some excited kid on set.
Yeah,
and it kind of helps that. So I love that focus on the importance of the vibe throughout the project. Cause equally it's a long thing to do to make a film. So you're all going to have to be there. So the more that can be a warm and positive and exciting place to work, the better, right?
Mm, yeah, absolutely. And you feel that you can, you know, you've got the freedom to deliver your best, and the support, I mean, you know, and the support and the trust, you know, because it's quite an exposed place to be, making a film, you know, but to put out your ideas on a daily basis, to you know, if you're the props man, you know, you've got to bring and go, I thought this was good. You know, you've got to be sticking your flag in the sand and be prepared for me to go, no, that's too new. I want an older version of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Go that's and find me good. The old one. Yeah, it's too good. It's too new. Go and find the old one so that they go up and you don't just, you know, shit on the idea and say, that's good, but let's make it older. Let's find me something that's got a bit more, or whatever it is. And I think that goes across the board, and it's, you've got to be aware that people are putting themselves out there.
Yeah.
But they've got to feel, if they're safe, feel safe to do it, then you'll get better results, in my experience.
Yes, yeah,
you know,
it's
such an environment that can be like, just be safe, play it safe. Everything's good, because there's a lot of money at line, there's a lot of hard work involved. You know, play it safe. But you, people deliver when you just go, there's room for you to dare. There's room for you to just bring something out. And it's like Stevie Graham, for example. It's like, you know, Steve is a great actor because he puts himself out there.
Yeah.
He's brave.
Yeah.
Which is what you got to be. And that's why you go, fuck me, Stevie Graham. Look, he's doing it. I never even thought that because he's brave.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got to create environments that let him be as brave as, because I always rein it back. You know, always pull it back. But
completely.
When someone does something that's dazzling, like, they go, great, that's what you get. And Taron's the same, you know.
I was going to say, building that atmosphere must have been key for Taron, because both Eddie the Eagle and Elton John, they're out there characters.
Yeah.
So he's going to have to push the boundaries or be brave to see how far he'll push these extreme characters.
Yeah,
and you're going to have to be the one to make him comfortable to make that push, because if it works, that's going to be the bit that makes the scene, that makes the film. But equally, it's possible to go too far. On Eddie the Eagle, with his weirdness and his oddness, it would have been easy to go too far on it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's finding that. So was that a good relationship to have there, that you two kind of had that place where he could push it as far as he wanted, because he felt comfortable, but you also were comfortable as the director to be able to say, that's too far, or go further. Yeah, go further. Yeah. Keep going. Keep that, going. It's Elton John. He's as big as you can. Well, you can go as big as you want. Well, yeah. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is absolutely. And I think that's why Tara and I have this good working relationship, is that trust and that my understanding of how far he can go, what he can do when he flies, you know, is really important. And he leads from the front, you know, being the leading man is a massive responsibility. Yeah. And, you know, especially with someone like Elton, who's got quite a bit of fuck you in him, you know, Eddie's all right. He's got his own, he's like, Eddie's got more fuck it than fuck you about him. You know what I mean? Yeah, he's like, fuck it, I'm going to go and do it, you know, which is one mindset. But fuck you's a bit more confrontational. It's a bit more out there.
Yeah.
You know, like Eddie, you could argue, is physically ugly, right? He's red hair and glasses and his chin and all his teeth and, you know, whatever your definition of beauty is. But Elton, because we're getting under the skin of Elton, we're getting right inside it, the ugliness is something else, is about how tortured he is and how that inner turmoil and self-loathing manifests itself. And that's a much bigger risk to take in a way, you know, that you know, Taron is, it's what I call the blood, sweat, snot and tears version of it. It is, and then we go, oh, warts and all. It's just so much more than that even. And it's brave of Elton to say, that's what you've got to tell, because, you know, addiction and dependency can be very ugly. They are very sort of selfish by their very nature. Yeah. That's part of what you understand when you get to that dark place. But also to have an actor who's like, that's the side we got to show, as well as the person who's a huge fucking world star on a different level. Elton's a superstar in the true definition of the word. Going, that's what you got to do. Because he's not that person anymore. He understands that. That's part of his history.
But,
so that takes bravery. That's standing out on the ledge and getting ready to jump and fly. But I think with Taron, through Eddie and working with him, that I understood that he has this incredible capacity to do this and desire.
Yeah.
It's about desire and commitment. And Eddie's a very good metaphor for it, because it's about someone who's prepared to throw themselves off a 90-meter jump with no parachute and see where he lands, you know, whether he's standing up or he's fallen. But that's an incredible amount of bravery. That's an incredible sort of commitment. And Taron has that as an actor.
Yeah. And again, it's maybe because I've been looking over it all in prepping for this, and I'm finding comparisons that aren't there.
But
it feels so comparative, because Eddie as a character is such a small town, he's such a British character, yet so you're watching him and it's funny and you're laughing, and it kind of allows you to forget that he's doing something really dangerous. Like, he's literally risking his life, and that's what I loved in the film, was you're laughing along and then you're suddenly heart in your mouth, because you're like, fuck, oh god, he's there, he's about to do this. And that's a beautiful thing to do. But kind of Elton had a similar thing, where he's this weird character with his crazy glasses, equally he was doing stuff that was really brave at the time, with his flamboyancy, his sexuality, everything. It was all there was a similar kind of risk there in the entertainment industry, I guess.
And look, you know, Elton didn't know when he went to the Troubadour at 23 years old and played a gig that 6 months later he would be selling out stadiums around the world. Madness. I don't know if he went, that's the plan, because no one had really fucking done it except the Beatles.
And that's more mind-blowing if you realise it's pre-internet as well. It's pre the kind of social media you can blow up overnight. This was when you wanted to get coverage, you had to fucking try and get an ad in your local for free newspaper or the enemy or whatever else. So to get that blow up in 6 months is
staggering.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
It is. And it's like, fair enough if you were like, that's my plan, I'm going to set out and do that. I think Elton loved, you know, what he did. He loved writing music. He loved performing. He found his way and who he was. But I think the meteoric rise of Elton is something that I can't see how he would have been prepared for, it because there was no comparison there.
Yeah.
The only comparison was the Beatles.
Yeah.
And that was a four-piece outfit who all had each other to rely on, or Elvis, who went before them even. Yeah. And that must have seemed like an alien landscape completely.
100%.
What Elton did by 71, 72, 73, 74, 75, while he's selling 4% of all the records sold in the world, it's unfathomable now.
Yeah.
It's incalculable. And he's mid-20s.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think there was a blueprint or a plan or someone to lead to follow. He was cutting his own way, and there was no kind of comparisons.
Yeah.
He was the first one to do it. And so, yeah, that's incredibly brave.
Yeah.
Because he's just absolutely, you know, he's beating the trail.
Yeah.
That others then followed. And in terms of, right, with his sexuality, with his music, with the amount of money he made, with, the, you know, the stadiums and just how he took it all on and how he developed his whole thing. And so that's what, for me, is sort of staggering and amazing.
Yeah.
Because he's very exposed.
Yeah.
And sure, he might have made some questionable fashion choices along the way, but you can kind of go, yeah, I kind of get it.
Yeah.
You know,
again,
because
it's a similar one. He needed that freedom to push the boundaries to find the points that did click. There's going to be some that don't quite click. There's going to be some that.
There'll some fall on, some fall away, and maybe the Donald Duck wasn't the best choice.
Yeah.
But we remember it. You know, that's what makes him iconic, because he went on and kept pushing it and kept trying to find what it is. And obviously that takes its toll, and the film looks at that and how that impacts him as a person in his own personal life. He's still a person.
Yeah. Which is weirdly hard to remember as well. I think we have a big issue with that in society at the moment in general with celebrity, that we forget that these are people. It's kind of, I always look at the amount of hate at times for people like your Justin Biebers or your Miley Cyrus or whoever else.
Yeah,
and it's like, they're not to my taste necessarily, but that kid's been globally famous since he was 15. He's not going to grow up normal. Do you know what I mean? No. There's going to be points where he's a dick, or where you can't impose regular expectations on someone who's living in a completely irregular world,
right? And who the hell are we all to judge anyway?
Yeah.
I mean, look, sure, it may not be to your taste.
Yeah.
But everyone's out there just doing their thing.
Completely.
No one's trying to hurt anybody.
No.
They're just trying to do their thing.
Yeah.
And some people, and then people say, "Hey, you're great. I love it. Do more."
Yeah.
So, okay, I'll do more. But I think that is, that's even the fallacy of people who, not the fallacy or the mistake or what's easy to misinterpret is, that fame is just the thing, that is in itself is enough, and that there's no cost to it.
Yeah,
even for Paris Hilton, there's a cost
of
being famous. You know, and people have to navigate through it. And like I say, you know, she's not to my taste, but she's just doing her thing.
Yeah,
you know, and it's hard to navigate. And I think if the film tries to look at anything, it tries to look at cost, personal cost of what you are trying to achieve in terms of fame, or what the price of that is, you know, what it means in real terms to you as a person, because it's really hard to go, oh, well, yeah, you've got all the money in the world and everyone loves you. Yeah. That surely is enough when it's not. Just, you know, problems are still problems. They're just, you know, relative. Those things have to be given some sort of credence and understanding as well. And it's just like, it's okay to want to be famous, but just understand there's a cost. And when you understand there's a cost, then you maybe you know what you're working towards or what you're fighting for.
Yeah.
And it seemingly can come easy, I suppose. It's a complicated one. It's tricky. I've kind of been in this zone myself in a way, you know, in my own experience growing up. And so I suppose that's why I find it interesting and to look at. And I know that it cost me at a certain point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I had to find my way through it.
Yeah. I mean, well, let's kind of touch upon that a little bit. How was it kind of at such a young age? And, you know, with Bugsy Malone again, still, it's no matter, again, the whole thing, there's no small roles, there's only small actors.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how small a role Babyface was, it's one of the iconic lines is pass this to Babyface, pass this to Babyface, I am Babyface. You know, it's one of the most memorable bits.
Yeah.
So having things like that, but then for me, a Press Gang was just huge when I was growing up.
Yeah,
and that was a young cast with the instantly an ensemble cast, but all young, all kind of blowing up. How was it to kind of have these things that were blowing you up at such a young age? And I guess at that point, it's all you knew as such. So
Yes, it was. I mean, it's like you talk about Bugs Malone, you know, at nine, you know, every kid at I went to school with had seen that film. And then school is your world when you're nine. You know, it's you know, and so everywhere you go, you're famous. So you just, to a greater or lesser extent, you know, in it's not like I walk down the street, but in my world at school, you know, I was babyface. That's who everyone, you know.
Every kid saw Bugsy Malone. That was
right. And you know, and the reactions to that vary from great to I fucking hate you. But we all suffer our own trials at school one way or another. Not, you know, there's this whole thing. It's like, oh, well, it's not a normal childhood or you never had a childhood. I'm kind of on the fence with that because I'm like, well, you're still a child. You just have a different kind of childhood. Every childhood has things to navigate.
Yeah.
I just had to navigate being well known, you know. But there was a kid at my school called Patrick James who was a really fast runner and he was great at athletics. Everybody knew who he was at school. It's relative, you know what I mean? And so he was known at school for that and I was known at school for something else and everybody's kind of known at school for one thing or another sort of, and that's the world you're in. When I think about Press Gang now, I think if it was now Press Gang and we were doing that show now and it had the kind of popularity it had back then in 89 or whatever the hell it was, I think we'd be in for a much rougher time than we even got then, because it's not like we couldn't walk down the street and you know, people knew we were, or we'd get mobbed, or we couldn't go on the bus, or we could. It wasn't any big deal. I just think even now it would have really been seriously on top. Yeah. You know, God knows, you know what it would be like, because there was a really voracious appetite for content and external content of the actual.
The intensity of the spotlight seems to have been turned up a lot, really, to the point that it's burning the skin of the people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't ever remember feeling like that, you know. I mean, you know, people who watched it were like, oh, yeah, great, the show. And now 20 years later, or whatever, 25 years later, meet a lot of journalists who go, oh, I loved it when I was a kid. Brilliant, because they're now writers and that writing is a creative, wonderful thing. And it, you know, inspired people to go out and go, I want to tell stories or whatever it is, you know, and that's something really to be excited and proud about.
And it's the kind of thing that sticks with you. I remember my excitement during Eddie the Eagle that there was a journalist in there, and I'm like, it's from Prescott.
It's Paul Reynolds, Paul Reynolds, absolutely,
So that was a buzz. That felt like a throwback. Like that's the same character. That's the same character grown up.
That's absolutely my... It's in there for those of us that know. Paul Reynolds is a great actor, you know, and like, you know, he's done some great stuff in between, but as like, as soon as there was this part for a journal, I'm like, we've got to call Paul. I'm like, Paul, do you want to come out and do this? He's like, mate, I'm there, you know.
Yeah.
And no, exactly, because I'm proud of that. And I love him as an actor. I love him as a friend. I'm proud of that. I want people to get the reference. I want people to enjoy, because it's not like I'm blind to, or I don't enjoy people telling me that they enjoyed something that you did.
Yeah.
I don't have an issue with that. If people say to me, I love that show, I love this thing, then I'm great.
Yeah.
What's not to like about that? I'm not like, oh God, please, it was so long ago. I've moved on since then.
I've developed so much.
It's absolutely to be proud of. And so, I do think that was something that I had to navigate it through my own way, you know, on a personal level, you know, what I found happened to me, and I don't know if it's true or not it for every child actor, is that I think either one or two things happen, is that you get to a certain age and you go, well, I didn't choose this. My parents did. And I don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
Like you might have been taught the recorder when you was a kid. And at 16, you're going, I'm fucking playing the recorder.
Yeah.
That's not who I am. I want to go and learn electric guitar. Yeah. Or, you know, you find out your own identity. And child acting, I think, is because that's how a lot of child actors don't make it. Because they fucking don't want to.
Yeah.
Because I never made that choice for myself.
Perfect example. A lot of child recorder players don't make it.
That's right. Exactly.
No one highlights that fact. It's not quite a documented
thing. Why are they not so worried about that? It's like, or you get to the point where you do want to do it. You go, right, like, this is what I'm, but then you've got, you know, there's a lot of innate, a natural ability as a child because you're playing. And playing's the easiest thing in the world when you're a kid.
Yeah.
That's what you're brilliant at. That's what you're designed to do. Use your imagination, use your physicality, get out there, enjoy it. And these are like key elements of being a secure, fun, good actor.
Yeah.
All the things that you have innately as a kid.
Yeah.
Now, if you can have all of that, but it's when people start saying, oh, you're really good at this.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. You should do that more. That's when you have to start thinking about it.
Or you grow up and self-awareness comes in, which is the poison for performance and for freedom and things like that. Right?
But also any performance, it's a craft. You've got to have foundation.
Yeah.
You've got to go and it's what I was saying coming back to earlier. Is like if I think about all the things that I did experience when I was younger, that maybe I discounted, like, oh, I was just lucky to be there. Then, you know, of course you're not just lucky to be there. It's there. You were there for a reason, and whether you felt you were enjoying it or good or not is another matter. But you do absorb it. You do. You do take it on, and a lot of child actors have to go away and really study. Only until I really started studying acting again did I find what I enjoyed about it when I was young. But these are, you know, the thing about the child actor is the first time round, it's just innate and you're great and it's all of that. You then have to go out and learn, and either you can do that or not. People do it as adults. Yeah. You just have to do it as a child.
It's a fascinating one, because it's going to sound like an odd comparison, but it makes me think of one of my favourite things in the film. It's weird because I heard someone talk about it on a podcast recently, is in Old Boy, and they have the reveal that all the time he's thinking about why he was locked up for that time, and what he should have been thinking about is why he was set free. And it's a similar thing there. If you spend all your time thinking about how you got that opportunity to be there, you should be thinking about the fact, oh, you were there. Mm-hmm. Forget that bit. Forget that it was luck, it was this, it was timing. Yeah, but you were there. So that's the bit that you should be remembering and focusing on and thinking about, rather than all the stuff around it that can be a distraction.
Absolutely, because it just absolutely holds you back. Even when you're free, you're just completely restricted. You've not left.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're not out of the cell. You're not out of the incarceration. And only when you get that, because you then do something like I did and go, oh, I can change track and embrace that. And I'm going to go, right, I'm going to go for directing. Yeah. What can I learn about that? What can I apply from all that time I spent there and bring it to this and keep moving it forward?
Yeah.
And it's absolutely true. And only then, you know, succeed or fail, but at least you're doing it for your own, you know, your own ends, or you're learning, or you're trying to grow within it.
Yeah.
And that's why for me, directing I see as a completely new chapter, and I feel like there's this really, I really got to learn quick. You know, it's a really different discipline. You know, acting's all about ensemble and the part, you know, that's what I learned, and it's all being a part of the whole. And then directing again is about, like, okay, but you're an island.
Yeah.
So, great. You know, and you've got to be able to lead the troops. And that takes a very singular vision and mind, and again, that's something you've got to learn as well.
Yeah, because when the actors are rapping and are at the end of the journey, you're kind of halfway through. You've got so much more to continue. Going on to the next gig.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've now got a time with this work to beat it into it, what it needs to be.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to craft it and make it into the film that it can be, exactly.
Yeah.
And the film that you want it to be. And that's a whole nother journey, because you get into the next level of it, which is, you know, dealing with studios and producers and mixing and music and sound and, you know, grading, and there's all these other massive amounts of elements of it that you have to sometimes go, yes, that's great, that's exactly what we need, and I'm like, no, I'm, and get emphatic about something where the people are going to push really hard on it. Don't fuck around, you know.
Yeah,
you've got to be like, you can't, you know, think about being an actor is generally, you're like, oh, okay, all right, I learn my lines, I stand here, I wear this, I put my hair like that, and, you know, I kind of generally do as I'm told.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've got my map, my roadmap through, but if it fits with that, I'm good. But it was, as a director, you're going to get things that make no sense to you at all, and you have to try and navigate your way through that. But that's part of the challenge.
I find I've always felt that it can help to get to understand a part of a job by having a focus on that part of it. When I was a musician for 10 years, and I was lucky enough to get to tour the world. But in that time, at different points, I did the job of a tour manager, or I did the job of merch, or wherever else, to get to understand it a little better, so that I could decide which bits I wanted to do, which bits I wanted to delegate. Do you feel on Bohemian Rhapsody, you joined it at more at the second half of that journey that we were talking about, because you who took over the project. Do you feel that gave you an insight and a focus on the closing part of directing, separate from that being there from the start and going over all the putting it together? You're at that point where, right, we've got it, we're getting more, and we need to make what we want to make.
That was an extremely unusual circumstance,
of course,
by anyone's standards.
Of course.
And it's a curious thing. I mean, you know, 30% of that film is officially directed by me. I came in when the train was moving. I had to sort of jump on as it was moving and, you know, see it through to the stations. And even then I had to come off it to get back to Rocket Man. I don't know how to equate what my experience was on Bohemian Rhapsody compared to in comparison to films that I've seen through from start to finish, because I came on and did what I thought had to be done to get it to where it needed to be. And so I think it's a completely unique experience in that respect, because it was an already moving train, is the only way I can describe it. And I just...
That makes sense.
And I just wanted those actors to have that opportunity and help everyone get it over the line and do what I felt was right and just say what I felt was my response to it. Like when any of us sit and watch a film and that we either like or don't like, I suppose we're making calls on it that are different from what we would do. Do you know what I mean? If you don't like a film, you're like, well, that don't make any sense, or I don't like that, or it's just an internal voice that. And so I just had to, I suppose I had the opportunity to go, not that I didn't like what I saw, quite the contrary. It's like, how do I make this, keep this going on that track that it's on and give it my taste? But even then I had to be reverential to and understand what my predecessor was talking about, what he was doing. And so, it's odd like that. I mean, I didn't feel like I've got to come in here and make this and do that. I just got to get it done. There's so many things at stake. So many people have been working hard and money invested and all of these kind of other elements. I just saw it as a great opportunity to be part of the bigger picture, which is what directing is. It's like, how do I, you know, with acting, you're, you know, it's something that was said in the theatre many years ago when I was a kid that I listened to older actors going, well, being an actor is like being a mushroom. You're kept in the dark and fed on shit, you know. And so I understood that acting's like one element of it. And it's like, how do you see what the big picture is, and how do you understand that as a director? All the plates that are spinning. And so I think I was just really more interested in that, what the big machine was here happening. And I knew that the film was good and there was great content. And it was a very particular thing that wasn't my thing. I did my 30%. And it seemed to work and people respond brilliantly to it.
Well, that's one of the things I was going to ask, because it's such a unique project and situation. I don't know, did that make it more or less rewarding when people seem to react so positively to it? And it did, you know, it's won awards, praised. Does that feel right? That could have been fucking awful because of the craziness of all the different elements. There's a chance it could have gone wrong.
No, because I'm in a win-win situation with that, aren't I? Because you know, if it's awful, which I kind of knew it wasn't, then I, you know...
It's not my fault.
I suppose I could throw it and go, well, I did what I could, you know. And if it's great, I get to enjoy that as well and go, well, I played my part in that. And, I'm proud of what I did and I made some great relationships and friendships there. And that's all very rewarding. I'm happy that those people get the recognition that I feel they deserve and other people feel they deserve. I'm in a win-win. That's why I went, I should go and do it, because I'd been attached to the project before and there'd been creative differences and blah, 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 and all this kind of, you know, drama about it 2 or 3 years ago. When the opportunity came, I just went, here's a really good opportunity. I want to be a film director. I am a film director. I need to learn more about it constantly. Here's a really great opportunity to go and learn something at no real cost, if you know what I mean. Sure, I was like, Dexter should get recognition. It's like, it doesn't matter. It's not what I did it. I got what I wanted from it. I am now of Rocket Man, which is my thing. I do have to take on the mantle of that. I do have to take on responsibility for that. I am exposed in that, and I'm proud of that, and that's what I'm ready for with that project. It was a kind of unique and great situation, and fantastically, people respond brilliantly to it.
Yeah,
and that's to its credit. You got to go. It depends what you go into it for, doesn't
yeah.
it? It depends what your objectives are,
and, yeah.
and mine were achieved just by even turning up on the first day.
Yeah,
you know, can I on the Thursday be talked to about this job and whatever, and on the Monday be ready to go do it?
Yeah.
That to me was really fucking exciting.
Yeah,
that was a real challenge.
Yeah.
I had what I learned, you know, immediately is that. In a way, the less attached I was to everybody who I was working with, because I didn't have time to sit down and work. I didn't have 4 months prep and working.
Yeah.
I just had to come in and go, right, this is what we're doing. I had to lead
yeah.
immediately, because they need, you know, we want to keep it going. Otherwise, yeah. it's in danger of, you know, all falling away. And
once
no
again,
one
you're
going
to have to pull everyone up, because it is in a situation, a project in turmoil in many ways.
Yeah,
that stuff has, no one knows. You know,
Where's the leadership?
Let's go.
Exactly? And that's what I have to, you know, learn is like what my leadership skills are. And that's okay to, you know, say, no, we're not doing that. We're doing this. And that's, you know, which isn't my natural kind of go-to place as a person. I'm going, okay, that's cool. We can work with that. Bend with it.
Yeah.
So in that way, it was a win-win. And then to see it do that, I'm like, great. That's
sweet.
Really good.
Yeah.
You know, Ram is fucking brilliant. You know.
Yeah, he's amazing, right? And I love him because he's not your stereotype. Out the packet Hollywood star.
Mm.
He is such a unique kind of guy and approach and character. Mm. And I love that he's becoming undeniable in everything he does, it seems. I'm jumping up and down all over
the
place. We'll start to wrap things up in a minute anyway, but you touched upon kind of potentially falling out of love with acting or deciding, again, as you said, a child star deciding it might not be for you.
Yeah.
How was it? I mean, you've worked in some of the most iconic gangster movies, and I'm putting Bugsy Malone in there, in history. So how was it when Lockstock came about? Because that seemed like a real resurgence or a really falling in love with that whole thing. It's another one. It's like Elton. It's hard to look back and remember because Guy Ritchie has now become Guy Ritchie. We know his style. He was the guy who gave me my first acting opportunity on King Arthur, and it was such an education to watch him on set and to see this guy. But at that point, he wasn't Guy Ritchie.
Yeah.
He was some guy kind of thing. So,
but
Lockstock had such a style, and Matt Vaughan, of course.
Even then, I suppose they just did things differently then. Anyway, those two.
such a distinctive style and such a distinctive approach.
Even in the casting of it and just the way that they approached it, I kind of think I was aware that, you know, there was a real sort of independent spirit of guys who were just doing it the way that they believed it should be done, and had this real sort of, got this real kind of belief in what they do and the way they do it. And he was still Guy Ritchie then in a way, you know what I mean? And same as Matt Vaughan was still, even though it was their first sort of real outing.
They've not changed. No, they seem to have made these huge blockbusters that feel like independent things.
But they
are, with Kingsman and all this
kind
of thing.
Their ethos, they haven't moved away from. I mean, on a personal level, I'd got to a point where I'd not fallen out of love with acting. I think I just didn't believe that I could do it, or I didn't have any faith in my own ability, and it's
an industry that can fuel that as well, right? Because
for stuff
out of your control, you could be busy or you could be not busy, and that can eat away at you and make you think, oh, am I shit? Am I not up to this?
You know? I think ultimately that's something you know when you hit it, you know when you don't, and if you've ever hit it, you know you're good.
Yeah.
And if your nerves get in the way or something gets in the way of it, you know that ain't it. But that's the galling thing. Like, I know I got it. I know it's in there somewhere. If I can just reconnect to it, I'm good to go.
Yeah.
And so, you know, unfortunately, it's a craft. And some fucking chairs you make are really spot on and others are a bit rickety.
Yeah.
And it's just, that one's not as good. And But you know when it's good, it's good. And I think I'd got to a point, it was actually the job before that I'd done in the theatre that really made me go, I had a moment where the light came on, I was like, oh, fuck, I love this.
When I find that,
it doesn't matter whether anyone else sits there and sees it or not, is that feeling I have, that's great, I'm good with that, and that's what I want to get back to. And then by the time Lock, Stock, Come Along, I had a whole new relationship to acting. I was reading a lot of books. I was really getting into the craft of it and stuff that I'd never really done before. I was always sort of winging it. Yeah. And now I understood that he didn't. And I was on Lock, Stock. I remember writing like 4 or 5 pages of character backstory about Soapy's real name and his family, his upbringing, and his dad and his family, and you know, this whole thing that I had sitting in a trailer, you know, a 3-ways trailer, tiny little thing, and I was getting real. That's why in Lock, Stock, my character's really serious.
Yeah,
he's a very serious individual. You look at him; he's like really earnest and all. Yeah. Because that's where I was with acting at the moment. It's like, yeah, it's really fucking serious, man. Yeah. And so that was reflective in my character. I still had fun, but I was trying to do something very particular, you know. But it worked for that particular instant, and Lock, Stock, in terms of where I was at as a young actor, as a young man, it was a moment that, it turned it all around for me, because before I'd kind of lost my way and ended up fucking presenting game shows about computers, which I knew fuck all about, and just was like, oh, how can I get some money? I've got to pay my mortgage, which I didn't pay anyway.
Yeah.
So I knew that I'd lost. That was the beginning of me, my next chapter of finding my way again. And so that's why I'm really reverential and grateful to Guy and Matt and that film, because for me it was so important personally.
I love that light switch was just before the film, though.
Yeah.
And because, again, I'd in the first few years of doing this act, I've done a few BBC things, a thing in FX. I've been really lucky. But it was literally 6 months ago I had an audition. Didn't get it, but that was the first moment I felt like a proper actor. Do you know what I mean? It was exactly the same thing where it just clicked and I found it and it felt right.
Yeah.
And almost identically, I was then on Amazon ordering numerous different books.
Right.
And I've been a studious student since, because it was that moment that went, right, no, this isn't something I'm trying. Mm. This is what I do. This is me. And again, it's beautiful when that moment was seen by two other people in the room, because it was a tape in a spotlight and whatever. It's like, it's amazing that those can be the things that spark it. I would look back and think it's Lock, Stock that sparked it, but no, the spark came just for that.
It's part
and
parcel.
Lock, Stock benefited from that spark and fueled it, kind of thing. You know?
But it's also what I try to put into Rocket Man as well. When in Rocket Man, Elton goes out into the troubadour and he plays for the first time, and I looked at that picture of him jumping up on the piano, which is a very famous still, and I like take that as like, how do you communicate that moment to a wider audience? What is the feeling of that? And the feeling is like, if you're all there together and something happens that is really sort of purely performance and just very free, it's only happening in that moment.
Yeah.
It feels like everyone's in it together, and it can feel like you're lifted off the ground and you're flying.
Yeah.
And so that's where that idea and that image for Rocket Man, where he plays Crocodile Rock, which is, he never did play it at the Troubadour in 1970. But everybody lifts off the ground, and it's trying to find a way of expressing that, because I know Elton understands that. Elton gets that, because when he read it, he was like, that is what it was like. And so that's what Rocket Man explores as well, is like not only the feeling of isolation that you can feel in your success, but also what makes you relentlessly pursue it.
Yeah.
Beyond. You know, the one moment of brilliant, of good, is like always outweighs the shit.
Yeah.
Because that's what you always like fucking fighting your way back to find. Yeah. Because one moment in Bugsy got me through 20 years of not feeling like I didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And
that's really important.
It's a blessing and a curse in a way, because it means you can't walk away now. You've seen that.
You
can't walk away. You're in.
And it's like, how do we communicate that? And hopefully that when people see that moment, everyone lifts off the ground. We just have that moment of elevation, and then boom, we're back into it. It gives that euphoria and that feeling. And I do think that you can have it playing sport. You can have it dancing in your kitchen.
Yeah.
You can have telling a story to a bunch of mates in the pub. You know, it can happen anywhere.
Yeah,
and it can happen to all of us, because I generally believe that's something that we all go, ah, oh, I know, I recognise that feeling.
Yeah.
That moment. And that's what I love about Rocket Man, what I love about Elton's story and Taron's performance and how we tell it. It has these moments of magic, and that's why it's a fantasy musical. It has to be.
I love that. I tend to wrap things up by kind of asking what's ahead. Number one, that's always tough with anyone in film or TV, because often what's ahead is something they can't talk about. But for me, the big question is, how's it going to be to potentially do a project that, I mean, because from Sunshine on Leaf to Bohemian Rhapsody to Rocket Man, the soundtracks that you've had to play with, the back catalogues, are next level. So unless the next project is a Jackson film, that's not going to happen at the moment.
No,
there's not a lot else that you could go to that would have that much back catalogue to play with. So what's the plan?
Eurythmics?
Eurythmics would be a great one. Yeah,
Dave Stewart.
Yeah, definitely.
Or Terry Hall specials.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
But it's amazing that, how does it feel
about subjective
to be looking forward and kind of deciding what's ahead? Or are you not in that space yet to be able to?
I'm not, in all honesty. Yeah. I mean, I'm just starting to emerge now. I want to see Rocket Man fly and I want to see how people respond to that. That's my kind of next station is like how, you know, I love it, but that's not enough anymore. It needs to now be seen by the wider world. And if it's half as good as I think it is, I think people are going to really, really get it. But in terms of that, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'll say, I'm not doing a biopic next. I might be saying Amazing Around the Corner.
Yeah, you never know.
I'm doing Da Vinci's life story. There could be any number of things. So
Taron could play Da Vinci?
Yeah, he could play anything. Play the banjo, he could play Da Vinci. It's an interesting one. I just want to choose carefully and smartly, and something that challenges me and that people are interested to see what my take on it will be. Whatever it is, and we'll be excited by that. That's what I would hope for. I'm sure I'll dig out something.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Cheers, Pip.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to seeing what is next.
Yeah, well, so do I.
Nice one.
Okay, mate.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. How good was that? I hope you enjoyed it. I think we probably talked about everything you wanted us to talk about, right? We talked about the new stuff, but we also talked about Bugsy Malone. We also talked about Snatch. We talked about Press Gang, man. So, yeah, hell of a conversation. I really enjoyed that. It was great to meet Dexter. I'd had him bigged up by Joe Hartley, who's next week's guest. Joe Hartley had told me he's a top dude, and she reckoned I would specifically get on really well with him, and she was right. It was a lovely chat. So thank you for tuning in. I'll be back next week. As I said, if you're about to, on Saturday, the 25th, this coming Saturday, come hang out at the book club with me, Stu Whiffin, Discotheque Credits, Doc Brown, Lindy Layton, all sorts of great people with great music being played. Come hang out. If you're not there, then I will see you all next week as I'm joined by the wonderful Joe Hartley on the Distraction Pieces podcast. Ta-ta.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.